I'm Mike and Scott, and this is a special production from The Pulse at WHYY. Science journalist Ed Yong is a must-read for millions of people with his in-depth reporting, his beautifully told stories, and spot-on analysis. During the pandemic, a lot of people felt like he was one of the go-to journalists for the most up-to-date and accurate information. On top of all the other things he does, Ed published a book in 2022. It's called An Immense World. It's about the sensory experiences of animals. The Pulse invited Ed to come to Philadelphia to talk about this book. We had an event at the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia. Ed talked about what he learned while writing the book, and he also reflected on what it was like to work on the book during the pandemic and why he thinks we might be stuck in an era of epidemics and pandemics to come. Here's a recording of our conversation in front of a live audience, and we also took some of their questions. Ed, how did you come up with the idea for this book, An Immense World? You've written about the microbiome before. That was your last book, which took us sort of inside into a very tiny world, and now we're looking out. So where did the idea come from?
Right, so there is a connective tissue there, right? Like a lot of my writing, whether it's about this or whether it's about the pandemic, has been about trying to showcase hidden sides to our reality. It's the microbes inside us, the information that we cannot sense that surrounds us, the structures that make us vulnerable to a new virus. So there's a sort of through line. But I think part of the through line became only visible to me because of my amazing wife, Liz Neely, who is the originator of the idea for this book. She works in storytelling and sense making in science communication. And she used to be a marine biologist who studied the way coral reef fish see colors. And in 2018, when I was bemoaning my complete lack of ideas for a second book and the imminent death of my entire career, and Liz gave me a great pep talk and suggested this as something that would be marvelous and rich and fulfilling to write about. And she couldn't have been more right. She's usually right about everything. And she's right in the fact that writing about the senses of other animals feels like an absolute gift. So for example, if I was here with my dog, he would not be able to see many of the colors that my eyes can see, but I wouldn't be able to hear some of the higher frequencies that he's capable of hearing, and I wouldn't be able to smell many of the delightful scents that his nose seems to pick up all the time. If I was sharing the space with a songbird, pick a songbird, or a robin maybe, I wouldn't be able to sense the magnetic field of the earth itself in the way the bird can, and use that field to guide its long migrations. So each creature really is only able to sense a small amount of the fullness of reality. That is the sensory bubble in which we're all trapped. And I find this idea to be one of the most beautiful in biology. At the same time, it is humbling and also very expansive. You know, it's humbling because I'm not sitting here aware of what I'm not aware of. Mm-hmm. And my sense of the world feels complete. It doesn't feel like there are holes in it, but there very much are. I'm only getting a partial picture, and that I think is a very humbling experience. But the concept is also expansive because it tells us how much we're missing, how much there is to understand and know about. And one route to doing that is to think about the senses of other animals.
And something your book really made me think about is how we anthropomorphize animals. And, you know, we anthropomorphize them in the way we think that they think that what we think is what they think. Mm-hmm. You know? So we think of their feelings and how they are reacting, but we're really also putting our own sensory experiences on how they see the world. So that really opened my eyes to that so much.
Yeah, I think when we think about anthropomorphism, we are often thinking about like cognitive stuff, right? So you talked about emotions. So we mm-hmm. map our emotions onto other animals. We map our style of thinking onto other animals. But the argument in the book is that we're actually doing that at a much more foundational level, because the senses affect the kinds of information we can take in about the world around us. They are like the building blocks upon which all of that like fancy cognitive stuff occurs. And even then, there's immense amount of variation and we take it for granted. We don't start from a place of thinking, this creature must have a very, very different experience of the world than I do. There's a very knee-jerk tendency to assume our experiences are the same. And that, I think, leads us astray. So in very trivial cases, it leads us to misinterpret animal behavior. Mm-hmm. So I give a couple examples of the book. I remember this viral TikTok video from last year showing a male pheasant displaying to a female. And he is giving it everything he has. And she is walking apparently off to the side. And so the whole joke was like, he's doing everything he can. She's completely uninterested. But birds have eyes that face sideways and their visual fields extend in a full circle around their heads. So often when birds are focusing their zone of most acute vision on an object, they're turning their head to the sides. They're giving it side eye. So this is intense focusing on what's straight ahead. So we misinterpret animal behavior. A lot of dog owners pull their dogs along on walks because they think that the exercise is the main point of it. And that's often true, but dogs are creatures of smell. Dogs love to explore with their noses. And if you yank a dog along on a walk as it's trying to explore with its nose, it's the equivalent of like going on a hike with a friend and covering their eyes every time they try to look at a sunset or a vista. And the whole final chapter of the book is about how in making this anthropomorphic error, we have filled the world with sensory information that harms the animals around us. Too much light in the darkness, too much noise in the quiet. All of these, I think, are consequences, some direct and some indirect, of the fact that we forget that even at this fundamental level, our experiences of the world are radically different.
And it even comes down to how we map our senses. So we think eyes for seeing, nose for smelling, tongue for tasting, right? Our fingers mostly for touching and sensing. Talk a bit about some of the surprising ways in which the senses are just mapped completely on different parts of the body.
Right, totally. We think of smell as being a thing that noses do. But when a snake flicks out its forked tongue, it is smelling. That's not taste, that is very much smell. Catfish have taste buds all over their skin. So if you touch a catfish, it will taste you. If you lick a catfish, you'll both be tasting each other at the same time. Then there are sense organs that can appear on all kinds of weird body parts. So what do we hear with? Two ears, two of them on our heads. If you look at insects, ears can appear absolutely everywhere. They can appear on knees, on abdomens, so butterflies with ears on their wings. Praying mantises have a single cyclopean ear in the middle of their chest. We have two eyes, they're on our head, they face forward. That's very strange as far as animals go. A lot of creatures have multiple eyes, scallops. Many people probably don't even think of scallops as animals, but they are. When they're in their shelled form, they have rows of eyes along the rims of their shells, which can be beautiful. Sorry for the people who just recoiled in disgust. I guarantee you they can be very beautiful. They look like little neon blueberries. Starfish have eyes at the tips of each of their five arms.
How do people study these sense perceptions of animals? So you mentioned the scallop with the many eyes. How do you go then from noting the eyes to understanding what the scallop might see? Like, how do you study this stuff?
So sometimes through hilarious behavioral experiments. So show the animal a thing and see what it does. There's a guy called Daniel Spicer. He's done some great work on scallop vision, and he did an experiment that he calls scallop TV, where he put little scallops on small chairs and showed them little movies of flecks of food drifting past in the water, and sure enough, the skulls would open their shells and extend little sensory tentacles out to explore. Hell of a thing watching a scallop be curious about the world. One of my favorite experiments in the book was by a woman named Lucy Bates, who studies elephants, mm-hmm. and was trying to understand better their awareness of smell. Elephants obviously clearly have a great sense of smell. There's the trunk, it's mobile, it's very sensitive. But how do they, like, what is their awareness of their world like? How is that grounded in smell? She did an experiment where she would follow a herd of elephants, wait until one of them pees, drive over after they leave, scooped up the pee-soaked soil into a Tupperware, and then find either the same group of elephants or another group of elephants, try somehow to predict where they're going, intercept it with the Jeep, and then just dump the soil stained with piss in front of them, and then see what they, and then she watched what they did. And if it was a completely different group of elephants, they would examine the soil and be like, no biggie, I don't know these people. If it was the same herd, they would be more curious. They recognized the perpetrator of the scent. But if they were specifically the same group of elephants and they knew that the elephant who made that scent was behind them, they were really confused. Because suddenly, because they have this awareness of where each member of their herd is, and that awareness is grounded by scent. So if you suddenly smell the odor of an elephant that you know to be behind you, it's like, did that elephant teleport ahead and leave the smell? I think it speaks to how important smell is to their social lives and to their spatial awareness of the world.
Can we also study how well-equipped an animal is to pick up those molecules? Like, what are we looking for there?
That is a much more difficult question, mm-hmm. I think. I point out in the smell chapter that there are a lot of factoids. If you read about animals and smell, you learn all kinds of little factoids that actually don't mean very much. I found like a ton of newspaper articles saying something like, elephants have a sense of smell 5 times as good as a bloodhound's. But that is an utterly meaningless statement, because does that mean that they can smell 5 times as many things, same things, 5 times lower concentration, from 5 times the distance away? This is why most of this book is not about simple lists. It's not about trying to give mm-hmm. people like little bits of trivia. It's about really trying to get into the heads of other creatures and trying to think about how they experience the world. Like the core pillars of this book are curiosity and empathy. Like really, really trying to understand how animals use their senses. And a really core part of the book was this idea that the An Immense World is not a book about superiority, but about diversity. So often, one common way of engaging with animal senses is to prize them only when they exceed our own. So an eagle's vision, or a shark's sense of smell, or the super senses. But my argument here is that the really interesting thing here is the variation. Mm-hmm. It's how disparate the experiences of other animals can be, so that even when you have something like a scallop, which has much poorer vision than ours, there is something truly fascinating about how it uses its eyes and what it gets from the world. And I think that is worth considering. Mm-hmm. So in 1944, a man named Donald Griffin coined the term echolocation to describe mm-hmm. how bats navigate through the darkness. They create high-pitched noises, they listen for the rebounding echoes, and they use subtle differences in the timings of those echoes to gauge things like distance. So just by hearing the sound of their own rebounding calls, bats can pluck spiders off their webs or like fly through a dark cave without crashing into stalactites. This sense, despite being actually recently discovered, is one of the ones that we can, it's almost like one of the easiest to study, because unlike say vision or smell, echolocation doesn't work unless the bat is doing something. It needs to put out energy in the world. The bat says Marco, and it makes its surroundings say Polo back. Mm-hmm. Because of that, by recording the bat's calls, you can kind of gauge its intent. So an echolocating bat will change the types of sounds it produces to get different kinds of information back from the environment. If it's flying in open air and it wants to find the one insect in this borrowed space, it makes a very different kind of call than when it's bearing down upon its target or when it's chasing an insect in the midst of cluttered leaves. The kinds of call that it makes then and where it's aiming that call and all kinds of other stuff, you can record that with a microphone. And it basically gives you an insight into exactly what the bat is trying to do at that moment. It's sort of like reading the creature's mind. And yet, you can't really read the creature's mind, right? Like, despite all of that, despite the technological sophistication that makes echolocation such an understandable sense, I still don't know what it's like to be a bat. And this was the idea from philosopher Thomas Nagel that there is always going to be this subjective chasm between my experience of the world and the bat's experience of the world that I cannot fully cross, no matter how good a microphone or how good an infrared camera I have. The only way to make that leap is through an effortful act of imagination, which is why I say that the 10 poles of this book are curiosity and empathy. You really have to try to put yourself in the shoes of another animal. I can take us so far through the book, science can take us so far through research, but it ultimately is a feat of imagination. And I think that's kind of beautiful.
We got a question that pertains to elephants. And this is, the question is the elephant's trunk more of a tactile or more of an olfactory, you know, apparatus?
That's a really good question. And I think it's both, right? It's very much both. What else is both a tactile organ and an organ of smell? Octopus arm. The sucker of an octopus's arm is loaded with both chemosensors that smell and taste and mechanosensors that detect pressure and feel. And one of the people I spoke to in the book, you know, has this feeling that for an octopus, like, these two sensations might not be distinct in the way that they very much are for me. You know, if I eat food, I can talk about the mouthfeel of the food, I can talk about the taste and the flavor of it, but those feel separable. That doesn't have to be the case for other animals. Like, an octopus might just have one sense of taste touch. You know, maybe an octopus is tasting the flavor of a shape.
I'm touching this chair right now and I'm just imagining, what if I could smell this chair, or what if I knew what color it was just by, you know, it's fun to imagine those things. You
it
know?
Is fun. Also, like, but how many people are sat on these chairs?
Yeah, that okay. Moving on.
Pretty terrible.
Another question. What surprised you the most in this research for the book? Is there anything that just blew you away, or did all of you just blow you away?
I mean, all of it.
Yeah.
I will pick one, but like in the chapter on vibrations, I write about these little insects called leaf hoppers. They sit on plants. If you have been in any kind of green space, like a park or a garden, I guarantee you will have been next to a tree hopper, a leaf hopper, even if you don't know what they are.
Do they eat the leaves?
They suck the sap from
plants. So they are like kind of aphids, a pest,
right? So they vibrate their abdomens and send vibrational signals along the stems and leaves and other bits of plants that can be picked up by other leafhoppers. Those signals are not sounds classically. They don't travel through the air. You can't hear them. You can put your ear next to the plant and you won't be able to hear them. But you can clip on a little microphone onto a plant and transform those vibrational signals into audible sounds. And when you do, and I talked to a man named Rex Cocroft who does this, what you hear are the weirdest sounds. The sounds that are, what do you think an insect ought to sound like? Like, probably like a cricket, right?
Yeah.
Like a small, simple chirping noise. What leafhoppers sound like when you transform their sounds into something you can hear are like, they sound like birds, they sound like musical instruments, they sound like maybe monkeys hooting, machinery. They sound melodic and weird and haunting and completely unlike either a small animal or an insect seem like they ought to be able to produce. And the idea that the plants around us all the time are just full of these like vibrational choruses that we can't hear is astonishing to me. Like, I went out with Rex and asked him to show me, and you know, we're going to some random park and he's clipping on a microphone, he's got a little amplifier, And it's a windy day and we're not hearing very much, mainly just the sort of rustle of the plants in the wind. And then after a while, one of his students says, "I've got something." And we go over to her, and from the speaker, what is coming, the sound of like some kind of fairy hyena. It's like a kind of giggling, like a high-pitched like noise. And it's incredible. And I asked them, like, do you know what species that is? Have you heard that before? Mm-hmm. And he went, "Well, not really. Like something similar to that, but definitely not quite like that." And partly that's because so few people know that these songs exist that no one goes looking for them. Which means that if you do go looking for them, there is a reasonable chance that you might hear something that no human has ever heard before. And I think that speaks to the subtitle of the book, right? The how mm-hmm. animal senses reveal the hidden realms around us. Like, this stuff is going on in every garden, in every park, and we are blissfully unaware of it. And now I feel blissfully aware of it.
Yeah. Next question is, how do we come to understand the existence, functionality, and properties of senses we do not have? So if a sense is just something we don't even have, so how do we describe it and try to imagine it?
With great difficulty. One of the later chapters of the book deals with probably the best example of this problem, which is magnetoreception. That's the ability to sense the Earth's magnetic field. I've already mentioned that songbirds have it, sea turtles have it. A lot of animals that migrate over long distances have the ability to sense the Earth's magnetic field and use that to guide their journeys at moments when other landmarks are unavailable to them, like clouded, moonless nights. But magnetoreception is the least understood of all the senses because it is by far the hardest to study. It is the only one, for example, where we still don't know where or what the sense organ is. Think about vision, right? I can tell you at excruciating detail, like the makeup of the cells in my eyes that detect light. I know the organs that those cells are in, my eyes. We don't have that for magnetoreception. And partly that's because magnetic fields are a very weird stimulus. They penetrate living tissue and are unimpeded by it. So while a lot of sense organs need to be on the surface, usually connected to some kind of hole in a shell or a skeleton, a magnetoreceptor, an organ that senses magnetic fields, could be anywhere. It could be in my knee, it could be in my elbow, it could be buried deep in my body. It could be spread out all across my body. We don't know. Someone who studies this described this to me as like maybe trying to find a needle in a needle stack. We only have like three reasonable hypotheses for how that hypothetical organ might actually work. Magnetic fields are also very, very weak. So the idea of something biological that's capable of detecting them is hard to wrap your head around. One of the most prominent ideas invokes quantum mechanics. That's the kind of like level of counterintuition we're talking about. And then finally, magnetic fields are just a weird stimulus. They're very counterintuitive. Like, how do magnets work? Right. It's hard. Whereas I feel like I've got at least an intuitive understanding of sound or light, right? And then I also have a rich vocabulary for describing all of those things. So language works in my favor there. Here you're talking about a stimulus which we don't really understand. We don't sense ourselves. We don't have a lexicon for. Like, that's incredibly hard to study. We just know that animals do it. And again, it comes down to like observations. So magnetoreception was discovered in the 50s and the 60s. When scientists realized that migrating birds that were kept in cages at the time when they were meant to migrate would get very restless, and not only would they clearly want to get going somewhere, they knew the way. They would hop in basically the right direction for their migration route even if nothing else was visible around them, even if they were like in a dark room, they tended to hop in the right direction. And that's how we first started to understand that some animals have internal compasses. How do those compasses work?
Were scientists often met with incredulous reactions when they put forth these ideas, when they were trying to explain how animals sense the world in such a different way? Because yes, it's sort of like, it's hard to imagine, and then it must seem like, oh, come on, you're making this up.
Yes, all the time. There's a long history of people, of some of the pioneers of sensory biology, being told that they were ridiculous. One of the people who first proposed this, the quantum mechanics idea of magnetoreception, had his paper hilariously rejected by Science, our leading journal. The two pioneers of echolocation, Donald Griffin and Robert Galambos, tell the story where Galambos gave a presentation about how he thought bats navigate, and someone afterwards just literally grabbed him by the shoulders and like was shaking, went, you can't really mean that, can you? And you know, Griffin writes about how in some ways this principle of Occam's razor, you know, this tendency to cast towards the simplest explanation leads us astray in this area, because it kind of works if you have all the right information at your disposal. But when thinking about the senses of other animals, we often don't. We're missing. So by casting towards the simplest explanation, we often go astray. And it's interesting that Griffin said this, because he himself was then skeptical about the ability of animals to sense magnetic fields. He didn't think that it was really possible, but did keep an open mind about it. I think that there's a point I make in the introduction where one of the biggest lies that's told about science and how it works is that it is a purely objective, very clinical, very cold procession of facts. Where instead it is just a very gradual and erratic stumble towards slightly less uncertainty. And it is profoundly a social endeavor, right? Like a scientist's interpretation of the world depends on the results from her work. And the results from her work depend on the kinds of experiments that she decides to run. The kind of experiments she decides to run depend on the kinds of questions she thinks about asking in the first place. And the questions she asks in the first place are dependent on her values, her culture, the dogma within her field at a time, all of these like deeply social forces. So yeah, I think that in this, as with all of science, it depends on who gets to be a scientist in the first place, who is allowed to do the work, who is allowed to publish in what journal. It's all part of the social construction of knowledge.
I think our next question is a good one too. Okay. Listening to Ed about the wonders of other sensory systems, it's difficult not to gain a sense of wonder and humility for yourself. But what might you hope to see people in the world do with this sense of wonder? What would you want us to do in the world with this sense of wonder once we start thinking about the world in this way?
That's a really good question. These are great questions, folks. Mm-hmm. Round of applause for yourselves.
Handwriting B minus though.
Oh dear. So I would hope that at minimum it makes people pause and take some time to think about the creatures around them. So I remember someone told me that they read the book and you know, the next night they saw a spider had spun a web on their bedside lamp, and previously they would have just like brushed their web away, and then they in fact just sat there and just thought about like what a web means to a spider. And that's kind of what I want, like a little bit more consideration and curiosity about the world around us and the creatures we share it with. I kind of make this argument in the final chapter of the book where I talk about this problem of sensory pollution, this idea that we flooded the world with too much light and too much noise in a way that's harming the animals around us. That not only harms animals around us and not only like kills sea turtle hatchlings or stops pollinating insects from getting to flowers, I think it also severs our connection with the natural world to everything's detriment. In the early days of the pandemic, a lot of people were talking about how they suddenly heard a lot more birds. And there was this meme, like, nature is healing, like, this idea that like suddenly animals were coming back into these spaces that humans were vacating. It's not actually true. What really was happening was that we just heard a lot more because we were quieter. When we pump the world, a world that is full of noise is a world in which we hear less and we hear over smaller distances. It literally contracts the size of our sensory bubble, or the amount of the surroundings around us that we can be in touch with. And I think all of that contributes to this idea that I think is very pervasive, and especially so in this country, where we think of wilderness as very remote and very distant. So think about, if I ask you to think about wilderness, you probably think about like Yosemite or Yellowstone or the Grand Canyon, like these big sweeping vistas. But wilderness also exists in our backyards, in our gardens, in our streets, all around us. We don't think about it a lot of the time because we drown it out and because we're not minded to cast the full force of our empathy and curiosity to the other creatures around us. And I think by giving people a little taste of that in the book, I hope that they carry that through with them in their daily lives. Because I think, you know, year of biodiversity is coming up. We are in the middle of the sixth mass extinction of life on this planet. And I don't think we can avert that unless people feel a connection to that life, unless they feel a sense of interest or a sense of care. It matters to them in their in their daily lives. And I feel this. I feel like just walking around my neighborhood, my experience of it is enriched by having read this book. The respect I give to even the most familiar of animals, a rat, and there's lots of rats in DC, starlings, sparrows, pigeons, is so much greater, like having thought about the ways they experience the world. And I think that that first step, that sense of connection, is invaluable and necessary for us to actually make any headway of protecting that world.
Totally different question. Do animal senses allow them to perceive qualities like beauty? I don't know if we can answer that, but it's a beautiful question to ponder.
Yeah, it is a very beautiful, it's a lovely question to ponder. And I think the answer is yes. There are definitely qualities about the world, about songs and other signals that animals find more attractive than others. And what better word to describe that than beauty? One thing I loved learning about in writing this book is that the senses often influence the form that beauty takes in the world. So it's very easy to think of the senses as just these passive intake valves for information. Like, I am sitting here, I don't seem to be doing very much, light's going into my eyes, sound is going into my ears. I'm not like actively absorbing it, it just seems to enter and then I deal with it. But I think that that perception downplays how important this, what a profoundly active role the senses have in shaping the world around us. So here's my favorite example. If you look at the colors of all the flowers around us, if you take all the colors of all the flowers that exist and you ask, theoretically, what kind of eye would be best at telling all of these colors apart? Like, whose eyes are flower colors geared towards? What you get is basically the eye of a bee. It is an eye that, similar to ours, has three kinds of color sensing cells, but that unlike ours, which are sensitive to red, green, and blue, a bee's is sensitive to green, blue, and ultraviolet. And that's a perfect eye for telling apart all the colors that exist in all the flowers that are out there. So you might think then that the flowers existed and the bee evolved an eye that was beautifully tuned to those colors. And that would be wrong, because the bees came first, and bees and other pollinating insects came first, and then flowers arrived on the scene later. So in fact, the colors of flowers evolved to ideally tickle the eyes of bees. And so by the mere fact of seeing, bees changed the form of colors that flowers take, the form that beauty takes on the petals of a flower. And there's so many other examples like this.
I would be sure this is true for smell too, because why do things smell good?
For smell, for hearing, like there are examples where the weird songs that some animals make were influenced by the peculiarities of the ears of the receivers of those songs. The ears come first, the song then tailors to fit the biology of the ear. With the flower example, I write that beauty isn't just in the eye of the beholder, it arises because of that eye.
That is a beautiful thought to hold on to. This question takes us back to the leafhoppers for a second. And the question is, how do the leafhoppers vibrate their abdomens?
This is a reasonably easy question. So they just have a special set of muscles that allow them to just shake their booty really fast.
It's the mega abdomen workout.
Just super twerking is how they do it.
So our two eyes create a single image that we mostly cannot tell came from two different eyes.
Yeah.
So this audience member is wondering if we know at all if animals who have, let's say, wraparound vision, do they do something similar?
Great question.
Do we have any idea about that?
Really great question. This comes back to the subjective chasm idea, right? Like, how can we know what is in an animal's head? I think the answer is we can't. How do I know that your eyes are combining their two images into a single thing? Well, you can tell me, right? But I wouldn't know without that. I would just sort of be making an assumption. Now, a fly has a compound eye with thousands of individual facets. Is it combining the images from those into a single image? I would assume so, but I don't know. With the scallops, it actually becomes even more complicated, because a scallop's brain is really, really simple. So is a scallop combining the images from its dozens, perhaps 200 eyes, into a single, like, wraparound movie of the world, like much like what you are all getting from this room right now? The scientist I spoke to, Diana Spicer, thinks probably not. Its brain is probably too rudimentary for that. And yet the eyes themselves are actually pretty good. They have decent optics. They're not like, high resolution like mine or an eagle's, but they're not bad for a scallop's eye. So the analogy we came up with is that imagine that the scallop's brain is a security guard standing in front of a bank of monitors, each of which is connected to a state-of-the-art security camera. That's the eye, right? The camera is the eye. But the cameras aren't feeding the image that they get to the monitor. So the guard isn't seeing the combined images of these hundreds of cameras. In fact, all that happens is that when the camera detects something interesting, it'll just send like maybe a thumbs up or a green signal, something that says, here is something interesting. So the guard just has this bank of monitors and it just gets like a little flash here, there, on something worth exploring with other senses like smell or touch shows up. So the idea is that this is seeing without scenes, which is completely different to what we have, right? I have a scene of all of you sitting here right now, but and to think about what it might be like for vision, the sense that for us who have sight is most familiar and most important. The idea, think about how that might work in a completely different way, I think is kind of mind-blowing.
Mm-hmm. I do want to pivot for a little bit to your reporting and writing during the pandemic. You spoke beautifully earlier about the process of science mm-hmm. and how it can be painful and also painfully misunderstood. And I think that is something that we all became aware of during the pandemic. So talk a bit about your own process of discovery as we were thrown into this period of time and what some of the biggest lessons have been for you.
Yeah, well, I was in the middle of book leave and I'd written half this book before the world imploded in on itself. Where to even begin with lessons from the pandemic? I had written about this before. Mm-hmm. I wrote, among other things, a big feature for The Atlantic in 2018, warning that America was not ready for the next pandemic. Mm-hmm. And turns out we weren't. One of the mistakes I think that even I made in that feature was to think of this problem, the problem of pandemics, the threat of pandemics, as primarily a scientific and a medical story. Mm-hmm. And it isn't. It's also a deeply social one. Mm-hmm. We have this idea of, let me give you a little history lesson. In the late 19th century, there were a lot of scholars who understood that epidemics are deeply influenced by social conditions such as poverty, squalor, sanitation, education, political malfeasance, overcrowded housing, unsafe work environments. One of them, Rudolf Virchow, famously said that medicine is a social science. And that idea of the social context of disease was completely displaced in the early 20th century because of germ theory, when we understood that diseases are the work of microbes. It gave people a very convenient villain to focus on. Mm-hmm. Now you didn't need to solve all these intractable social problems to control epidemics. You just needed to stare down at the bug under a microscope and find a way of annihilating it through the judicious application of research and technology. An idea that also fit very well with America's love of technology as panacea. This way of thinking, this biomedical paradigm, influences how even today we think about disease. At the point when vaccines became readily available, the posture from many influential voices on the pandemic and certainly our political leaders was jobs done. Mm-hmm. Like, we got the product that beats the thing, so we're done. But the product is useless without the systems that allow it to work. Vaccines are useless without actual vaccinations. And all of those systems rely on those social conditions that had been neglected at the turn of the 20th century. They rely on things like access to healthcare infrastructure. They rely on things like trust in the government and in each other. And if we don't have those things, and America kind of doesn't, like has spent several decades shredding a lot of those things, then it doesn't matter whether we have the fancy biomedical doohickey, it won't work. Or it won't work, it'll work at an individual level, but it won't work at a societal level, which is what we need. These are fundamentally collective problems, and you cannot think of them solely through the lens of individualism or individual risk analysis. Mm-hmm. So I could go on mm-hmm. this for hours, and in fact have done for 3 years. But I think that's one of my most important lessons from this. Like, if we think of this solely as a biomedical problem to be addressed solely through the application of the fruits of the biomedical enterprise, we'll fail. Mm-hmm. And because we have done that, we set ourselves up for failure next time.
Yeah.
This is not going to be the last time we deal with this problem. We are now stuck in an era of pandemics, of epidemics and pandemics, and more will arrive. And this cycle of panic and neglect, this inability to fix some of the social problems that make these things bad, means that we are left with the same vulnerabilities that cascade from one pathogen to another. The same groups of people who have felt the heaviest burden of 2009 swine flu, but exactly the same people who were most badly hit by COVID, who will be exactly the same people who will be most badly hit by whatever comes next. Mm-hmm. So we, like, short-termism kills us, individualism kills us. Thinking of this through the narrowest of lenses, rather than these grand, sweeping, collective problems that they actually are, kills us mm-hmm. again and again.
Yeah. I was working in the year before the pandemic, just by complete coincidence, about a yellow fever epidemic that swept this region in 1793. Mm-hmm. And it was so shocking how much the same themes were present, the politics of it, and who has the right answer, and who is going to be affected, and where does it come from, and how does it spread, and what can you do? And it was like so eerie to read those accounts of the fear and the confusion. And yet somehow I didn't think that this was going to happen in my lifetime too. There is a certain way in which we delude ourselves, I think.
Yeah, we absolutely do. I mean, even at the start of the pandemic, I one of the things I wrote was that experience is ostensibly a great teacher. One of the reasons why a lot of East Asian countries did really well at controlling COVID was that they had experience with mm-hmm. things like SARS. A lot of African countries with much fewer resources than we did really well because they've been dealing with multiple epidemics for a long, long time. And yet experience doesn't seem to have been a teacher in this case. What happened in March 2020 was that we entered a new world that demanded new solutions. But instead, by repeatedly trying to swerve back towards the old normal, we foreclosed to the possibility of doing better at this. Because, as I've said in multiple pieces, normal led to this. Normal wasn't some like golden age status quo that we need to get back to at all costs. Normal was a set of baseline vulnerabilities and weaknesses that makes a really, really wealthy nation still ridiculously vulnerable to a novel pathogen. And we're still vulnerable now.
As a science communicator, this was also an incredibly humbling time where I'm sure all of us felt insecure about mostly what we didn't know, and yet there was the need to say something or to report something. So how did you handle this constant uncertainty?
Yeah, I think by running headlong towards it. You know, you've heard me talking about the book for most of the evening, right? And mm-hmm. and I've repeatedly said there are cases where I just don't know. Like, I don't know what a jumping spider sees. I don't know what a scallop sees. That ability to just say, I don't know, and to recognize the limits of my knowledge and what is maybe even possible to know is a crucial part of science writing. It's a crucial part of this profession. I think working in these kinds of topics in these areas trains you to be okay with uncertainty and with not having the answers. I think a mistake that our profession makes is to think that our job is to give people simple answers. Mm. And it's not. Our job is to help people make sense of the world. And the way to do that often is by making clear what we know and what we don't know, by showing our working, you know, showing the steps as we think through a problem, helping people to think through a problem, showing them like lines of argument, counter arguments. If there is uncertainty, you don't have to just show it to people and be like, "Rrr." You can say like, okay, what are the bounds of the uncertainty? Why is there uncertainty? You know, with like, why do we not know how magnetic reception works? I've told you why. Like, and that's the sort of thing that you can do when reporting on a new virus. Like, mm-hmm. why don't we know the answer to this question? Why is this so confusing? Over what time frame might we expect to be less confused about this? Like, we can answer all of those questions And it makes a difference to people.
Yeah. Two quick follow-up questions. One was, why do you say we're in an era of pandemics?
Well, history clearly shows that to be the case. There have been either new emergent diseases or re-emergent diseases appearing at a pretty regular drumbeat for the last several decades. Every president that we've had has had to deal with multiple ones of these. 2009 swine flu, Zika, MERS, right. Another coronavirus, and Ebola in West Africa. So when Trump was elected president, I wrote a piece headlined How a Plandemic Would Play Out Under Trump, because one probably would do, we could expect that to be the case. And COVID started under his presidency. So when Biden became president, one thing I said repeatedly in a bunch of interviews was, well, he's due an epidemic of his own, so we should expect something new to arise in the next couple of years. And now we have a monkeypox epidemic. Mm-hmm. So I will tell you that before the next presidential election, maybe we'll have something else. And if we don't, then in the next 4 years, we will definitely have something else. But then also, like, not only is this a regular thing that has happened and will be expected to happen, but the pace of it will probably get faster for a bunch of different reasons, not least of which is climate change. Yeah. So here's just one mechanism, several, that will mean that a warming world is a world with more diseases. As the climate warms, animals are being forced to relocate to track their preferred environmental conditions. And that means that species are changing their ranges all the time. And that means that animal species that never previously coexisted will suddenly find themselves living in the same place because they will have moved. And that will give opportunities for their viruses, which were unique and special to them, to jump into new hosts and then eventually into us. There was a very good paper that came out this year showing exactly this process, that it is well underway and that we are living through probably like the golden age of that process of what I have termed the pandemocene in my reporting. The horrible thing about that is that a lot of the spillovers will be concentrated in areas with high human habitation, and that process is now effectively runaway. Like, even if we halted all greenhouse gas emissions today, the momentum of climate change will mean that increased spillover dynamic will continue happening.
Mm.
So this goes back to the point I said earlier, right? We have to get better at this. We cannot simply just cast back to the way things were before, because the way things were before was a situation where 1.1 million people died in this country alone in just the last 2.5 years. More than 7,000 Americans have died of COVID since Biden declared the pandemic over on September 18th. Mm. Let's just sit with that thought as we think about the other epidemics that will probably happen.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry to bring this all down.
I'm going to bring it back to your book.
Talking about scallops and...
Yes, I'm going to bring it back to your book because okay. I do think, you did write this book during this time to some extent.
Yeah.
And when I read it, it came, sort of not after the pandemic, I won't say that, but it came at a time where I felt like I needed this book because it was such a beautiful way of immersing myself into a totally different topic and in seeing the world in a different way. But I do think the book brings us back into this appreciation of nature, of the creatures around us, of our interactions with other species. And hopefully with this empathy that you kept talking about tonight and this bigger thinking about our planet leads to perhaps more action on climate change, leads to a lot of good things. So I do think it is all connected in a way.
It is. And I took 4 months off at the start of 2021 to finish this book in the middle of everything. Right. And it still mattered to me. There was a point in 2020 where I was like, do I ever go back and actually finish this? Like, it doesn't feel important anymore. Mm-hmm. But I do feel that it is important for all the reasons I've talked about, because of the importance of biodiversity, because of the power of actually getting people to care about something. I think that a lot of the problems that we've experienced in the pandemic boil down to a catastrophic failure of empathy. And while I'm not naive enough to think that learning about like scallop eyes is suddenly going to make people take actions that protect their fellow humans, I do think that empathy is a muscle that you can flex and build and strengthen. And I hope that this is part of it. I also know that despair is lethal right now. We have a huge number of global, massive problems that need constant attention and persistence. And I think that, so the abolitionist Mariam Carver talks about how hope is a discipline. It's not a nebulous, fluffy thing. It is the thing that requires effortful work, constant effortful work. And I think to sustain it in the face of all the challenges and the tragedies that we see around us, we need to embrace things that bring joy and that bring hope and that bring wonder. And that's part of what this book is about to me. It's why I went back to it. And like, it was, finishing the book kind of saved me at the start of 2021, because pandemic reporting is hella bleak. Mm-hmm. But delving into this made me feel better. It restored and rejuvenated me. And I hope that that is the experience that readers will have now at this time of, you know, when we're grappling with what the last 3 years have meant. I think in some ways this is completely unrelated to my pandemic work, but in many ways it's all part of the same through line, you know, the idea of curiosity and empathy, the idea of seeing the hidden things in the world that sometimes we would prefer not to see and sometimes we would enjoy seeing more of. But it's all part of the same the same package of values and ideas.
Well, I'm very glad you did return this book. And I want to thank you so much, Ed, for coming and for being here and for spending this beautiful time with us. And for all that you do to give us different visions of the world all around us. So thank you, and thank you all for being here. And thank you for the beautiful questions.
That was a conversation with science writer Ed Yong. His latest book is called An Immense World. We recorded this conversation at the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia, and we'll be doing more events there next year. Be sure to follow our podcast to catch our weekly episodes and also our podcast extras. Special thanks to the Commonwealth Fund for their support. This conversation was recorded by Nicole Curry and edited by Alan Yu. Our engineer is Charlie Kyer, and we had additional engineering from Al Banks. I'm Maiken Scott. Thank you for listening.